Hello, hello.
This microphone is working. That's excellent. That's excellent. Welcome, everybody. I think we might be a minute or two early, so folks are still filing in. This is the informal warm-up phase of the session. The doors are closing. It's very exciting. We're here for our March Madness 2024, Sweet 16 of Learning Trends. I'm Mike Palmer. I'm the host of Trending in Education and the founder of Palmer Media. Been doing this podcast since 2016, so 8 years, 600 episodes. So, you know, we have a little bit of experience. And all three of my panelists have appeared on Trending in Ed at least 3 times, which means they qualify for refrigerator magnets, which is important. And maybe we could do a quick introductions, beginning with you, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa Griffith, Kaplan, North America, VP of Strategy and Corporate Development.
Beth Redden, I'm the CEO and chairwoman for Bast AI.
Robin Naughton, I am an assistant professor, web and digital services librarian, interim deputy chief librarian at Queen's College. Also, I work with Palmer Media on some of their technical things.
Yeah, I married well, so she is my technical lead. And God bless you, Matthew. My son just sneezed. So but we do have a five-year-old in the audience just to be truly diverse and inclusive. So the podcast, you know, we try to be kind of like South by Southwest in that we're intentionally broad. Like we're interviewing folks who may represent K-12, early childhood ed, right on through enterprise. And increasingly, it's been a lot more about artificial intelligence and the massive transformations we're in the midst of. And so each of us spent a little bit of time working on some trends. We're going to share the trends right up front. Also, these trends, they are a March Madness, so folks vote on them. I'll be sharing stuff on LinkedIn. You can vote on them throughout the month of March, and we'll come up with a winning trend out of the 16 that are listed here. We'll talk a little more about the methodology, too. We were using humans and also AI to get this stuff together, of course, because it's 2024. So with that, let's kick it off. I'll count us in so I can edit this better. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Trending in Education. I'm here in front of a live audience. How are we feeling today, Austin? Wow. That's pretty good. But now I got to do it one more time because that's what you do. No, seriously, Austin, how are we feeling today? I thought so. We're here in front of a live audience. This is amazing. I'm Mike Palmer, joined today by Melissa Griffith, Beth Rudden, and Dr. Robin Naughton. We'll get into it with each of them in a bit. We're sharing on the screen here our 16 trends that we're watching in 2024. These are the big reveal. You're welcome. And for our listeners, we will share this when this episode goes out. Actually, we'll be sharing this on our website, trendingined.com. It'll be up on Thursday when the voting starts. So these are the trends. We'll have this slide up mostly throughout the session so that we can remember what we're talking about. And like I said, it's human generated AI ranked. So we did use OpenAI, Gemini, Claude, and Perplexity AI to do the ranking, which was interesting. So we're trying to play with the tools that are out there. And, you know, Beth in particular, I think is going to share some really interesting ideas around artificial intelligence and the work that she's been doing. But to go around the horn, maybe starting with you, Melissa. We wanted to maybe highlight one of your trends and go from there.
So the trend that I'm pushing for, and I really think you guys should also push for, is hyper-personalized learning. The way I'm thinking about that is not just hyper-personalized learning, but it's also bite-sized learning as well. So if you think about how today's youth learn TikTok, YouTube videos, like I watch a 10-minute YouTube video to learn a new skill, and that I think is even too long. I think more and more you're going to just take in 2 minutes. I want to learn this topic. Like today, LinkedIn Learning fed me on their daily learning. This is how SEO works. It was like 2 minutes, like a TikTok video, and it was amazing to do it. And if I want to go deeper, I can go deeper and learn more about it. But I get a breadth of knowledge learning quickly, and I can go deeper on it. So why I think this is important for us is that I think in the next generation to come, especially with the use of AI, and other areas, I think AI is going to force us to be able to get what we want when we want it. And so just sitting in a traditional classroom, I think it's going to go away. I think the pace of learning, even in corporations, which is what I'm much more familiar with, I think this type of trend is going to make us learn better in organization. And we're going to be able to keep up with the way the world is going to change.
What should we do about it is use the tools?
I think use the tools. I think embrace AI more than shy away from it. I know it's risky, but I think AI is going to be, and I'm sure Beth is going to talk about this. You're for sure going to talk about it.
Pressure's on.
Uh-huh. But I think AI actually is what you put into it, right? So the way we train it is it's the way it's going to respond back to us. So I think the more we embrace it and the more we look at it as a tool to help us rather than a tool that's going to change the world, I think it's going to be better for us.
Yep. And you mentioned TikTok too, like a trend we've had in the past, I think we called it like TikTok U, but like TikTok is another, it's interesting that AI is on top of existing trends that were already there. So generative AI came out, but the TikTok generation's already out there. And how are they going to engage with this stuff? How are they going to learn? And then especially in K-12, just show of hands, folks who are in K-12. In the audience? Yeah, a big chunk of the audience. You know, how you engage with this generation, you know, they're called Alpha Generation, but I've been calling them Gen AI, which is, you know, kind of on a little bit on the nose, but it does seem like they're going to be growing up. My five-year-old already has AI toys and talks about artificial intelligence and robots in ways that I certainly didn't when I was five. So the world is absolutely changing. Hyper-personalized learning for those of you voting at home. All right, so Beth, you're up.
I'm going to talk a little bit about ancestral intelligence. And this is a play on words that my friend Adam Starcaster and I were thinking about. And this was his idea, but I think that it's really good in the fact that AI or artificial intelligence really implies that something is created out of nothing. And that is not our providence. So I think it's much more like ancestral intelligence. And we're doing a little bit of this. And there's a great write-up at Maryville University, where we're connecting the generations, so connecting the alumni to the students. And, you know, I think of ancestral intelligence as also things that we can learn from Indigenous people. And I think that we can really start to think about, like, artificial intelligence is not really adequate enough to really start to think about the fact that it comes from the data, it comes from the people, it comes from the people who are creating the data. And it's ancestral. It's something that we want to pass along to our children, too. And the idea of ancestral intelligence is that it's something that we have the ability to all participate in, where, you know, there's like, I don't know, somewhere around the line of like 51 archaeologists that wrote all of human history to date. And now that we have this new tool, ancestral intelligence, think about the amount of human beings who can participate in really being able to write that next ability of history or her story and all of the things that we've been missing. Now we have the ability to really create ancestral intelligence that will actively help introduce the idea of how do we augment human intelligence with ancestral intelligence? How can our children that we borrow our world from learn from our mistakes vicariously instead of having to make them again and again.
Yeah. And Beth, maybe just for context, can you catch folks up on what you're doing at BAST and how it's maybe a contrast to the LLM wave that's here?
So BAST AI, I opened it in 2022, and everything we do with ancestral intelligence or artificial intelligence is it shows its work. And so you understand what data was used and why the artificial intelligence responded in the way that it did with referenceability and attribution. And so we have built and really changed the order of operations and engineered a way where everybody can participate and understand how the AI is taking from the source data and reasoning against that in order to be able to show the human how to reason against the source data. Currently, we are running lots of pilots. The one that I'm going to showcase later on today is at Maryville University, where we're helping nurses learn and nurses be able to use our AI that is only against the source in order to be able to ask it for quiz questions or mnemonics or scenario-based questions in order to really start to establish a knowledge companion that can help people learn how they learn. And that's, you know, directly into your hyper-personalization, because we have to start using ancestral intelligence or artificial intelligence to augment human intelligence.
Yeah, and a couple of things. There's a quote that Beth uses a lot, which I now borrow religiously, which is data is an artifact of human experience, which it's easy to kind of treat it as though it is the voice of God or robot overlords. And in fact, a lot of what we're getting from the LLMs, we don't even really know where it's coming from. And that's where, just before we move on to Robin, just around the language around AI, there's responsible AI, there's explainable AI, there's a bunch of terms out there. Which of them are kind of pointing in the right direction, and which of them do we want to be a little more cautious about?
I really like responsible AI and explainable AI. And I will show this, but if you're interacting AI and you can't change its reaction without changing your question, you're not in control over it. And that's something that the type of artificial intelligence that BAST is building is the next generation. This is not something that we've seen before, but it is the generation of artificial intelligence that is augmenting people and working with you. And that's super important because, you know, a lot of people talk about ethical AI or all of these other terminologies, but they're not showing their work. And at the end of the day, I really want people to understand that there's so much possibility once you actually have AI that can explain itself and show its work. It really becomes something that you want to play with, you want to trust, you want to engage with.
The other thing I've heard is human-centered AI, which is another, you know, human-centered research and user experience. I know that's a lot of what Robin works on. Robin, which trend did you want to talk about?
I'm going to start with mental models. How many people have heard of mental models or, oh, great, awesome. So the idea about mental models is that, you know, we all have these views of the world, these models that live inside us that we have created through our experiences and our interactions with the world, and we use it to make decisions. And one of the things that I think is a trend that's happening is that mental models is coming back. You know, there was a time when, you know, we focused on it. It kind of waned a little bit. But right now, you can find mental models in a lot of the kinds of work that we're doing. In UX, it's becoming a bigger deal. In thinking about students and designing things for students, it's becoming a bigger deal, particularly in terms of user experience. If you try to design and build for someone, you want to understand what are their models, what are they coming to my product, my class, any situation you can think of, what do they have already? And I think one of the things why this is important is that as we start to really try and understand how do we design, build, teach people going forward, one of the things we should do is figure out, well, what are they already coming with? What do they already have? And when I say the word search, I'm sure there's a picture in your head about something. When I did my original research, one of the pictures in their head was Google. So, you know, on librarians know this, if there's any librarians in the audience, you'll know this. Google became a model that a lot of people have about search. And librarians spend a lot of time trying to understand, well, why does this model work and why people have this mental model when they think about search? So, getting into mental models and understanding mental models and trying to draw out mental models, which is one of the big parts of it, is like, how do we even find out what is in someone's head and what they see and what they expect the response will be in the world? So that's one of the things I think is important and why we should start to draw that out and get more of that kind of information.
Yeah, makes sense. And what folks should do, I guess, is be conscious of the fact that there are different mental models out there. There's a really interesting intersection between mental models and DEI, which is another thing. I know you were talking about allies.
I can kick off another one. So in thinking about mental models and thinking about DEI, one of the other areas is this ally to accomplice. And the idea behind an ally to accomplice is that a lot of people are allies. They are of a dominant group who want to help a non-dominant group in terms of dealing with these DEI issues or interactions and so forth, which is great. But the other step of that and what we're trying to get to is the idea of an accomplice. So what do people think? You know, you can just scream it out when you hear the word accomplice. Exactly. And so what we want people to understand is that that is the first impression that people have. And I'll ask you to do one more thing. When you think of ally, what is the impression you get? Like, what's the first word that comes to mind? Right. All right. So both of those things are mental models. So when someone says to you, hey, can you be my accomplice? Your mental model is like, that's a crime thing. I'm really not getting involved in that. And then when someone says to you, can you be my ally? And you're like, that's, oh yeah, I could be your ally. That's being a friend. And so you already have these models. And trying to understand accomplice with this particular trend is the idea that accomplice is about action. And allies generally are not taking action. They're there for you. They support you. And when something goes down, they're like, oh, we're with you. You're right. But the next step in the process, and this is a range, is to be able to say, oh, I'm going to actually participate right now. I'm going to take an action that's going to make a change, that's going to help someone. And to be an accomplice is to be that support, to be ready to fight with the person you're with that you're trying to support. And, you know, the criminality piece of it, you know, gives it a little bit of a bad rap, but
I like it. It's edgy. It's also transgressive. You're putting yourself at risk where, yes, like the challenge that's out there around the ally is that it's, you know, sort of performative wokeness, you know, virtue signaling, which is a real thing where folks, like, it's easy to say something. It's hard to do something that you might lose your status, lose your job, go to jail. You know, like there are points where the level of resistance that might be necessary for change reaches a point where you actually have to put yourself on the line. Yep. And that's why I do think this model is an interesting one. Any reactions to that from panelists or from the room? It's provocative.
A lot of the work that we do in BAST is we ground information to an ontology or a knowledge graph, which is a mental model. And ontology is from the philosophical side of the house, where we study the nature of your reality based on the language you use. And the use of ontologies gives people context, or gives the machine context, to understand what you are talking about within that context. And so how, when I said we change the order of operations, we take your data, we ground it to an ontology, and then from that point forward, everything that you're interacting with is against that context so that you understand that mental model and you can change them. So if you would like to see yourself against a mental model of the skills of a data scientist versus a nurse versus a construction worker, and using these types of contrasts or these types of mental models is actually really allowing people to increase their awareness of how other people are interacting with the world and how other people see the world. And I think we should totally do more together, because that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So lots to talk about on that one. It also does relate to things like code switching and intersectionality, if you think about it, where like people come with multiple mental models. And one of the things that is also a trend is like around adaptability and fluid intelligence, which in some ways is a human ability to switch models and be able to say, in this context, you know, we all contain multitudes. Right now, I'm going to think about it as a middle-aged white man. And then next time I'll think of it as a Mets fan. I contain more multitudes than that. But but that's at least, you know, a little bit of context. And I think that's really true of all of us. And it does relate also to AI, where, to your point, Beth, if you can get a little more specific about your data set, rather than these large language models where you don't know what it's coming from, it's just a big munge of models. And it's also kind of regression to the mean a little bit, where it's all the data that's been on the internet, which is also not representative. And then it's, you know, munged together into like the average stuff. So like to get the variant data, which is something I also got from Beth, we kind of need more of that. It reminds me of, even within stem cell research, there's actually a problem that minority populations haven't been tested enough. So a lot of what we benefit from around stem cells is not necessarily as widely available because we haven't sourced it in a truly representative way. So there's a lot, I think, to chew on among all of this. I'm going to introduce my trend now. I'm debating between one of two. I'm going to go with enshittification versus premiumization, and my son's covering his ears. The concept of enshittification comes from a blogger, cool dude named Cory Doctorow, who was talking about how technology platforms have a tendency to get shittier over time. And AI is a good example of that, where like the LLMs, when they first came out, 3.5 was cutting edge. Everybody got it and it was free. The adoption was amazing. Oh my God, OpenAI, everyone's using it. It is really revolutionary in that sense, where everyone had access to AI. But since then, the landscape has started to change, where there's really two two trains leaving the station. One is people who use AI versus those who don't. Hands up if you've used an LLM, used a chat GPT or something like that. Okay, hands up if you haven't. Thank you. Excellent. It's good to have diversity of perspective. And actually, it'd be great to maybe hear from some of you, because I think we also kind of assume you're at a education conference, everybody's using this stuff, and that's not necessarily the case. But yeah, as everyone has started to use it, there is the train of users versus not. And then the other one is premium versus non-premium. So the idea of the free version starts to get more junked up. So it's actually like we're forking the situation here, where those who can afford it, whether they're in an enterprise or they can afford $20 a month, or if you're subscribing to all of them, closer to $80 or $100 a month, which starts to add up, you know, suddenly you have access to all this, you know, amazing intelligence that you can do. And then the free stuff is going to continue to get worse. It's going to be more ad supported and it's going to continue to be shittier. So that's really where, you know, it's also a case of the haves and the have nots, where like who's actually going to have access to these tools. And one of the messages, I think, is that we all need to be activated. We need to be accomplices in ensuring that there's wide adoption of these technologies, because they are really powerful, but there's a lot of risk that comes with them. So that's mine.
That was one of the trends I kept looking at, was as AI comes more prevalent, exactly what you're talking about, I think it's just going to be even more gap widening. Like, we're coming out of the pandemic, students are having a hard time catching up already. And I think just the technology gap you saw there between students who had access to technology and those who didn't, I think AI is just going to exacerbate that, because now you have a way for folks to learn, like students who have the exposure to it, to learn more and more. And I worry that unless we do something more institutional, the other kids are just going to fall behind. And the kids who do not have access to this kind of technology are going to fall way behind. And I think you're going to see that a lot in this year.
The other term I've heard is AI washing, which is kind of like whitewashing, where everyone's saying with AI, like powered by artificial intelligence, where pretty much everyone can say that. And how are you actually going to check them on that? So that would be maybe get a little bit of your perspective on, as folks who don't have the same level of understanding of the industry as you, how do consumers or entrepreneurs or folks who care about the future of education, how do they figure out what's safe and good to use and what may be trickier to use? Any thoughts?
I think a good way to describe this is back in, you know, the before times, before ChatGPT came out, we were doing a ton of work on helping people scale AI and operationalizing AI. 85% of models never went into production because people didn't understand how to do the software engineering to express the input and output of a model as an API, and then run data over the model so that you could have a feedback mechanism in order to make the model learn and change. And this is a huge problem, because a lot of people pick up ChatGPT or pick up the APIs and they have a web developer put a front end on and then they have a chatbot, but they have no ability to have the test retest reliability. If you ask it the same question, it's going to give you a different answer every single time. So there's a lot more into building an information system too, to carry state or memory. And all of these components get trickier and trickier and trickier. When we built the AI at scale data science methodology, there were over 52 distinct roles. There were over 254 work products. It takes a lot of different types of people to make something useful to be solving business problems. So when you're talking about, you know, artificial intelligence that you're using on the web or putting a wrapper on it and being able to kind of pick it up and put it somewhere, it's very different than, you know, passing SOC 2 compliance or making it, you know, comply with GDPR or CCRA or making it something that the enterprise can use. And you talk about that division or stratification, the socioeconomic stratification that is happening with access. It's also about privacy. And, you know, how do you know what OpenAI is doing in using your training sets? Most of the large companies locked it down the minute it came out because they didn't want, like Samsung had it, they didn't want their IP becoming part of the training sets right. of the artificial intelligence.
To me, what I keep coming back to there is Napster. When Napster first came out, we all kind of adopted it. And then before you know it, the IP protections kind of caught up to it and we realized, oh, okay, we don't really have access to that data. And now I think New York Times and Universal Music Group, there's a bunch of lawsuits out there right now against OpenAI around how they source their data. Was it behind a paywall? Was it actually free, open
data? Do you have consent to use this? How did we grow up a whole generation of people who thought everything on their internet was theirs to use?
Right. Yeah. And then similarly, how do we, this is interesting within academia too, is like, how do you credit it? How do you talk about a citation? Robin, any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is definitely a conversation that's happening in higher ed right now. I mean, and I think across education in general, people are trying to figure out, well, you know, if everyone is using this, how does this work in courses, in teaching and in learning? And, you know, you've got the one camp where it's like, it's plagiarism, you know, but then you have the other camp is like, we actually need to learn and figure out how we're going to integrate this stuff, because whether we like it or not, it's here and your students are using it. And if your teachers are not using it, they need to figure out, well, what is the implication for this? If someone submits their paper, I saw someone do representation where it's like, can you tell the difference between this student's writing and this generated writing? And sometimes you can't. It's getting better at writing the way we expect it to write. So that's something that we have to look at. The other thing I think in terms of teaching and learning, and I'll talk about citations because we're doing citations, is that, you know, a lot of these tools don't necessarily understand context. And there are many cases where citations are completely wrong, doesn't exist, made it up. But does your students know that? Do they have the critical thinking skills to kind of decipher this information? And if we're not talking about it and we're not teaching them about it, then they're not developing those skills, which is the skills we need to work with these tools. We need those critical thinking skills. We need those abilities to be able to, you know, use the tool and understand what the tool is doing, which is gets back to, can we find out what the details are and then make really critical decisions about what is it good for? What can it do that is good? What is it doing that is not? And how do we integrate that in education, in learning, and in teaching? So yeah, it's a big discussion point at this point.
I'm going to take the counter view here, only because I, like, as somebody who, from the time it came out, I don't think I was exposed to AI. Like, I wasn't thinking about it a lot before ChatGPT came out. And then as it came out, Mike will tell you I'm one of the people, I just jumped into it, right? I use every version of the LLM that I can get exposure to.
And you call them all Fred.
And I do call them all Fred. That's my code word for who helped me on work. It's usually Fred that has helped me.
So that is a citation. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that is my citation. But I do, right? Because I know, like, I work at Kaplan. I'm pretty sure, like, all our books have been fed into ChatGPT. It's why it's so good at SAT prep questions and all the other questions. I'm very curious what you think about this, Beth. Is the way I think about it is the information's out there. Mm-hmm. What OpenAI and Perplexity and Gemini have all done is they're allowing the human to synthesize information at a much faster rate, right? And so if I read every book known to man, right, I would also have this kind of information. That's what it's done, right? And now it's fed it to me at my fingertip. So I'm curious, like, how can I call that plagiarism when it's like, I know it's coming, right?
So a really good friend of mine is one of the top programmers in the world. And she, you know, I love her quote on this because she's like, AI is great if you're already wise.
Yes.
And so she's like, if you know the right questions, which you know the right questions, and you know when you're like, that's not Shakespeare. You know, I mean, when you are discerning and you're already discerning, you're already wise, AI is a brilliant tool. And specifically, the language models that can generate, because what it's meant to do is find patterns. And so it's finding the patterns in text and stitching them together. So of course it can do analogies and scenarios and mnemonics. And there's so many things that you can use if you're already wise. But we have a generational gap about the value of attribution. And, you know, the way that I really try to explain it is the way that you value information is that you have created the labor to understand it. Because understanding is a labor, not an act. And when we want to buy a Picasso, the auction house has to prove lineage and provenance in order for that to be a Picasso. Materials matter, sources matter, attribution matters. And, you know, I don't think that that's going to change because we as human beings value things that we do in order to take the time to understand them, understand the story, take from the past what we love and remix it and make it relevant for today. And I don't think that that's a bad thing at all to go coincide with this, you know, this like generative cheese grater, as long as you are already wise.
I love it. Yeah. I do want to bring up some other trends that maybe are slightly less AI related, though it's similar. Misbelief in the crisis of trust is an interesting one where I don't know if anyone's familiar with Dan Ariely, the Behavioral Economics, Predictively Irrational. Dan Ariely wrote a book about not misinformation, but really from the human context of misbelieving and what is feeding people's, you know, tendency to accept things that the rest of us may not view as true or factual or based in knowledge. And trying to understand the messiness of humans is something that I think AI is provoking in us to a level that we actually need to be even more thoughtful, which is why also I think mental models are kind of making a comeback, and anything that is kind of going deeper into human psychology, human decision-making, and then in truth, like human flaws, like the fact that our reasoning, we're more emotional than rational, like the forebrain exists and then other stuff kind of grows on top of it. You know, like we have a very emotional, irrational foundation. And that's why there are some real risks, whether, you know, you add AI into the mix, it makes it even riskier. But the fact that we have a tendency to misbelieve, there is sort of a cult psychology that humans can clearly gravitate to. And if you add to that the fact that we were all at home for a few years globally, on our phones, on the internet, on social media, being fed our echo chambers, you know, there is some real risk to really where human psychology is right now. I've also heard it talked about as a crisis of civility. What I loved about what Dan Ariely does in the book is he was actually attacked by conspiracy theorists. They were saying that he was working with Bill Gates to, you know, include chips in vaccines because he's a behavioral economist. So, you know, he would help them figure out how to get more people to take the vaccine so that they could be mind controlled. And rather than, I don't know how I would have reacted, but a lot of his PR people were telling him, just hide, you know, just go away. But instead, he actually engaged with that audience. Many of them now are his friends, and he interviewed them. His response there was that the way you deal with misbelief is you try to empathize with the misbeliever while still speaking your truth. And, you know, another thing that he talks about is rather than getting into a debate about a fact, just present your own facts. And like, don't engage in a battle. The other thing I have heard is that it's an order of magnitude greater to contain bullshit than to create it in the first place. And that's kind of where we are. That stuff is generating a lot of these language models and we don't really know where it's coming from. So I would definitely recommend that book. It's really thought-provoking. And I think anything that shifts the focus to more human-centered and also understanding the hard work that we're going to have to do, because I am concerned about the dystopian future of WALL-E, where it gets a lot easier to do a blog post or to write an email, and something that might have taken you 30 minutes, you now can do in 2. What do you do with the other 28 minutes? It's a good thought. You know, like, do you spend it on social media or do you try a different LLM or do you get another expert or do you just think more critically about it? Any thoughts on this stuff?
I mean, just to answer your question, I think you become more creative. Like, I think I have benefited, as I've said quite a few times, I've benefited so much from ChatGPT and all of them. I think what it's done for me is I do a lot of more high level thinking. So you and I had this discussion the other day where I said, yeah, I used to be able to spend 2 hours doing a task. I can now spend 5 minutes doing it. But instead, I spend 30 minutes doing it. I like to engage with the OpenAI. And
yep.
So I tend to have arguments with OpenAI. Like, I will flat out, I will put something into it. I will be like, here's a question. Like, what company should I be looking to buy, right? It will give me a couple of answers. And I'll be like, no, I don't like that. I don't think you're thinking about it the right way. What about this? Sometimes I've said, Fred, you flat out lied to me. Why are you lying? Because it does do that a lot. And so, but I do engage with it. And I think your point was so valid that I can do it because I do still have a high BS tolerant. And that's what we have to teach people, right? Like OpenAI, you should use it. I absolutely believe you should use it. But you also should not trust it. Like I trust very little things openly. Yeah. Right? And I tend to do fact check everything that it gives me afterwards.
Yeah. Absolutely. We have a question. Yes.
My name is Kelly Ryan Bailey. I have been thinking a lot about the last bit of the conversation you've been having, not only around misbelief and crisis of trust, but also data privacy. And the one thing I think of, because there's a lot of K through 12 people in this room, and I have kids too, you know, the way that they are interacting with an open source model, how they might be putting in information, the questions we might be asking, giving a lot of data to an organization, potentially a handful of organizations. I think we're all a little concerned about that, but how do we teach the teachers, the students, you know, and what do we need to worry about?
Small correction, it is not open source. It's OpenAI. And they do not show their sources. They do not give us an understanding of the weights and measures they're putting there. We have no understanding of their training cycles. We know that they take large volumes of compute, like 15 swimming pools of fresh water per model cycle training. We don't know enough. And the concept of data privacy, the concept of, you know, trying to get open AI, which is not the appropriate terminology because they are not open source. They have refused to show what sources they've put in. I think that we need to go about that with caution. And I also think that you really need to think about whose interests are you looking out for. And the technology is not the problem, it's the business models. And I'm in a funding cycle, and there's been a lot of people who ask me, well, how are you collecting the data so that you can sell it to advertisers? This is not a secret, but when we're talking about our children, you know, there is some caution that I would put forth and, you know, kind of quip a little bit. You know, data is an artifact of human experience. And in 2013, one of my peers got on the TED stage and she goes, I can infer whether you've done drugs or not with 4 of your likes on Facebook. 4. So when you have a really large statistical data set, you can infer a lot from a little bit of information. So I would be cautious in all of those things, but also discerning where, you know, where are you consuming from?
Yeah. There's also, I haven't read it yet, but I don't know if folks are familiar with the Kids Book About series, but there is now a version of it. You know, they did a kids book about racism, a kids book about death, a kids book about whatever you need to talk to them about. They just released a kids book about AI. So I think it will be soon on your reading list, Matthew. We will be making sure he checks that out. And also as parents, another trend that didn't quite make it, parents as learning partners. And it does seem like if we could equip parents and teachers with the right tools to teach that discernment in a developmentally appropriate way, it's really important. And it's going to be more important for the rising generations even than it is for us, hashtag olds. We have another question.
Hi, yeah, it's in relation to what you were saying about having to be wise and the critical thinking. And I think many of us are thinking about, as a K-12 educator, what do I do about my students who are maybe writing essays, trying to use ChatGPT or whatever through that, and maybe getting these simple answers? But what I'm thinking about is, how is this going to drive deeper learning? How you think this might drive what that might look like?
Writing is the place where we've seen the biggest challenge, right? Like the typical 5-paragraph essay as a homework assignment and as a summative assessment to say, okay, give me a finished product that looks like a good 5-paragraph essay. That's gone. Like, you can't really do that anymore. But what you can do, I think, is something more formative, where you actually give the assignment, you allow them to use the tools, and then you ask them to explain, getting back to the importance of explainability, how did you use these tools? What did you see? I will say, even the fact that, as simple as it was, you know, coming up with the rankings, it was surprising to me that, you know, all 4 of these LLMs were really interested in mental models. I was like, that's interesting. Just being able to compare and contrast and actually use the tools. The other thing in K-12 is understanding acceptable use policies around this stuff so that you can actually incorporate it into your teaching practice. Because if you don't, I think there's a lot of risk there too. So I would say it is a time to be innovating in K-12, but it's also a time to be conscious of the fact that these tools aren't really built for kids and, you know, especially younger kids, you know, you're doing it with them. Although at the same time, Matthew loves Alexa. He's got his AI toys. He loves robots. Robots is like your favorite class, right? Yeah. So it's an interesting time, and I certainly empathize with folks. I don't know if you guys have other thoughts.
You know, one of the things that, and I think Beth said this, is that, you know, it's not the technology, it's our use of it. It's our models about what it means. So a lot of times what happens with technology, something new comes out, everyone is like, oh, the technology. That's really not, that's an issue, a separate thing. But what's important is that, you know, we as humans, we as teachers, we as learners, have to figure out how do we use this. And when new things come online, it becomes like the thing you use for everything. You must use this thing. But the thing that we have to do now is kind of step back and say, well, what is this good for? And what can we use it for? When ChatGPT came out, I was teaching a class on technology and writing. And, you know, the big conversation in a college classroom is like, everybody's going to just like plagiarize and write this. But the question that I ask and the question that I think we should all ask is the goal of teaching a writing class or teaching people how to write a 5-paragraph essay? And if that's the goal, then they have a tool that can do that for them. So what do they actually need to learn? Because what you want them to be able to do, and I know, you know, critical thinking is a big phrase, but what you want them to be able to do is to say, okay, this tool is capable of doing this. What am I capable of doing? And how would I use this tool? And how would I interact with it? And I think for K-12, if they're using these tools, you should also work with them with these tools, because they're going to do whatever comes and they're going to get their information where they get it. They're going to learn things about it that you may not. But if you're not engaging with them on it, then they're not learning how to decipher. They're not getting that wisdom so that later on when they use these things, they can clearly say, that's incorrect. That's correct. That works. That doesn't work. This is the way I should use this. This is not the way I should use it. And if you're in K-12, they have to be taught this. You have to teach them, how do I discern this? How do I become wise about my use case and using these tools?
Yeah, absolutely. I've likened it to the old Fred Astaire quote, Ginger Rogers had to dance just as well backwards in heels. I'm not sure who's in heels and I'm not sure who's leading all the time, but I think it's an interesting analogy where, you know, you kind of do need to assert your kind of executive function in engaging with these things. And I think the risk is that younger folks and folks with less discernment don't necessarily have those tools. So I think it's a new challenge to K-12 and honestly higher ed and lifelong learning. How do we teach that literacy? Because the haves and the have-nots, it's not just an economic divide, but it's also almost like a mindset challenge. But we have more questions and I'd love to hear them.
I want to pull together what you talked about with mental models in terms of implicit bias and the bias that's naturally going to be embedded in AI, but also the misbelief, the crisis of trust, and then also polarization based on what Kimberly Crenshaw and Jonathan Cox talked about in our keynote. This idea of, you know, we've got generational gaps, we've got political divides, we are canceling everything on both sides. We are also banning what can and can be taught and said in schools around gender, sexual orientation, race, all of those things. How can technology serve as a bridge and also be used for social, racial justice in education so that it can be a tool for good and not just a tool that we all need to use to make our jobs easier or us more productive, but actually as a tool for good?
Yeah, I love that question. It's kind of, how do you, as an accomplice, you know, how do you actually affect change versus some of the dominant versus non-dominant mental models that are out there? Thoughts?
You only interact with artificial intelligence that models what you value. One of the ones that I have up there is biomimicry. When we create the engineering, we fit form to function. We bank on diversity. And, you know, that's what nature does. And so we use the models of nature and photosynthesis as an example in order to be able to understand how to build things in a way that models what we value. Reciprocity is a beautiful thing. When you're interacting with an AI system that understands what you're saying and then 2 weeks later says, hey, you asked me these questions and then you didn't interact with me anymore. Here's a better answer. I was listening. I just didn't have the right answer at the time. Is this better? Create tools that model what you value and only interact with the ones that do have attribution, that do only use the type of compute that is needed to use in order to get the answer to the question. And I think that that's a much better way to think about it, because human beings, they do what you do, not what you say.
Yeah. What I like about what you're putting out there, actually, I don't like it. I love it. I got that from my five-year-old. What I love about biomimicry and some of the mental models that you're describing is that, you know, ancestral models, maybe indigenous models, that might be a way to do it as well. Like when you're introducing some of these concepts, calling it ancestral intelligence instead of artificial intelligence and explaining why, that's kind of the most you can do with a young person, because you're kind of giving them the mental models, the schemas that they're going to use to engage with the rest of their lives. Question.
So I work in higher ed. And so I see you have a couple trends up there, post-trend foresight and future shock.
Yeah.
Which is some of my background, so I'd be interested to hear more about that.
Yeah. Post-trend foresight, there's a guy named Matt Klein, and we cited him in the citation here. He's really great. And he did a post that, you know, my podcast is named Trending in Education, and he basically said, trends are dead. And I was like, okay, maybe I need to rethink the name or something. But it's kind of true, and it's really well thought out. And it's, you know, especially with, you know, sort of that finding the average. Also, Todd Rose wrote a great book called The End of Average, and basically the risk of thinking about things through like the average use case. You know, it's a time to be thinking outside of those norms and trying to understand new ways to do scenario planning. The other thing I've heard around scenario planning and futures thinking is that you want to think about multiple possible future scenarios rather than just one. And you want to think about both positive scenarios, negative scenarios, and then based on the timeline that we're all living in, a lot of weird ones, because it does feel like, you know, how do you account for the randomness and the oddities that were like, I would never, if you talked to me in 2022 when I was on the stage, I would not have anticipated probably more than half of these. And I certainly would not have anticipated how much artificial intelligence is really predominating all of our thinking. So I would say, like, make sure you're planning for AI and its disruptive capabilities. But I would also say, you know, just like anything, there's a hype cycle for this. There's probably a tendency to over-index on artificial intelligence in terms of your strategy. And that's where I would say, like, try to cast a wider net. Look at what else is out there beyond just technology. What other social forces are out there? What other cultural phenomena are out there? Like, polarization is up there for a reason as well. I'm a proud alum of New College of Florida, which for those of you who are aware of what's going on there, you know, there's a new board of trustees who's been installed there, who's now really changing what was that sort of experimental liberal arts college into something that is more kind of part of the culture war from a conservative perspective, because there's really a tendency towards two higher eds now, one in red states and one in blue states. And that's a massive trend to account for as well. Like, what are the state policies? Lots to think about in higher ed. I know you're in higher ed, Robin. Any thoughts on that question?
I think, you know, I'm going to throw analog interaction in there as well, because if you're thinking about, you know, strategies and ways to kind of develop things, technology is not your only tool. You have a really large tool set. And what technology has done is make us think less about things that are just analog, just talking and communicating and doing human-centered things. I think because AI is so in all our minds and the digital is such a big part of it, one of the things you have to take the time to do is just to do human things. And to do human things is, you know, in terms of collaboration and communication and actually being with humans and doing those kinds of things. And I think that's something that we have to also put back into our toolkit, because it hasn't disappeared. It's still necessary. As digital as we are, one of the things I talk about too is just like the hybrid world. As digital as we are, we still need those interactions. Our tools have not reached a point where human interaction is not necessary. You know, our tools have reached a point where it augments our interaction and it helps our interaction, but we also need to say, hey, this is a very human thing that we do, and this is how humans interact in certain ways. And I think making sure that when you're planning your strategy, it's not just like all AI all the time or all technology all the time. It's some kind of hybrid or some kind of multitudes where you draw from all these different ways we interact and communicate and deal with the world and really think about solutions based on that. That's the diversity part. You want to make sure that there is diversity of thought and there's diversity of action and diversity of tools when you're thinking about the future. And higher ed is slow to do certain things, but they're starting to think about what does that look like? What does hybrid look like? We have probably 6 flavors of what a class in a college looks like these days. And so that's not solidified. It's still in process. So we're trying to figure out what works for what situation and what context.
And also real quick on the higher ed side, there's demographic cliff is still out there. Like there's going to be fewer and fewer graduates. And we kind of lost a few planning cycles due to the pandemic. And then within the pandemic, there was a lot of learning in higher ed about how to use technology, how to use online learning, how to go hybrid. And now there's been almost like an overreaction to move back to in-person and away from online. And I think a lot of that is probably driven by the financial models where it's harder to justify the tuition when classes go online. And then that's where it starts to get complicated in a few different ways. We're getting close to time. We have one more question. Yes.
Yeah, I'll just say quickly on that. I actually think higher ed's biggest threat is not technology, but the return on investment. For many students that go into higher ed, that value is no longer there. And then, like one of the trends we didn't cover, but was post-secondary pathways. I think if higher ed does not figure out a way to reinvent this model to be much more ROI focused and career driven, I think they're going to face a challenge with, are students going to go there, or is the workforce a better option for them to go straight out of high school?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we left off the disruption because there was a disruption at the end there. And there's another session on the podcast stage here with Paul Fain on a new podcast he's doing called The Cusp. And it's very much talking specifically about this. You know, what is higher ed doing? What is the workforce doing? You know, it's a challenging time for all of us, but certainly for higher ed. You got to play with your head up. And then from a strategic planning perspective, you know, it's probably a time to be almost more innovative, even though I think there's a tendency to kind of pull back post-pandemic. We have another question.
Hi. So a lot of the things that have just kind of been piquing my interest that I've heard, such as this idea of exposing more youth to this technology, because after a while, if they don't have that opportunity, they're going to be a little left behind and thinking about like acceptable use and some of the things that have been mentioning, and what keeps popping up in my head is like ethics. And I'm kind of like an old school, I'm a journalist by trade. And so back in the day, ethics was very, very huge, you know, if you were an up and coming journalist. And so, and maintaining journalistic integrity and maintaining integrity of information. And we've talked a little bit about open source and that as well. And so my question is, like, is there an ethics conversation going on as technology is expanding? If so, how do you plug into that? Any thoughts or advice about giving youth more opportunity to engage in technology, but also along with that kind of ethics training that can incorporate like these ideas of safety and acceptable use and using it ethically?
So two things. You know, one of the things that we can choose to believe is that every human being involved in the creation of any AI system, including the companies that are sponsoring it, are accountable for its impact on the world. And if you look at ethics as whose interests are you protecting or what kind of ethics, ethics comes from the word ethos, which means atmosphere. What is the atmosphere that we want to set up as adults in order to make sure that, you know, a child understands how to use AI responsibly? It's like everybody knows you don't walk into a Catholic cathedral in ratty jeans, start cussing. How do we know that? You have to set up the atmosphere, and it takes work, and it takes accountability, and it takes responsibility, and it takes people who are saying, I am accountable for this system's impact on the world. And I think that that is how we get ethics involved. And lots of people, and I do lots of bits, and there's a lot going on with regulations, but regulations are after the fact, and they are stress tests. It typically takes, like, it took the banks 10 years to pass the stress test that we set in 2008. Where we are right now is everybody has a choice. How are you going to be accountable for this AI system and the impact it has on the world? And that's something that we have to figure out how to do as a community of human beings.
And I think there's a lot of education of the marketplace, the consumers themselves, around which platforms are more ethical than others. And then ideally, usage will move in a direction that is more aligned with where we want it to go. Although I am concerned, I guess, if you look at what the social media generation of technology has done to us, and now this is the next generation, where if we didn't learn lessons from the previous generation and we're not like conscious of what we should do differently because of it, it's a kind of dangerous landscape that we're heading into. And that's why I was really happy to get Beth here. And then I also think, as much as everyone was saying you need to learn computer science, I think there's going to be increased interest in psychology, philosophy, things like ethics that ultimately will raise critical thinkers and folks who actually understand how to engage with this.
The best regulation is independent thinkers.
Concluding thoughts from our panelists as we wrap up here. Quick around the horn. Robin, final thoughts?
I would say just think about who you're working with and what you're doing, and think about the models that they bring to the thing that you're working with, and try to understand what those models are so you can respond appropriately to them.
Do it with the kids. I am riveted when I watch masters of their own domain interact with ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Riveted.
Yeah.
And do it with them.
Awesome.
OpenAI and AI in general is here to stay, so use it responsibly. And the more we have people using it, and the more people that are using it are actually teaching others how to use it appropriately, the better we'll all be.
Fantastic stuff. The name of the podcast is Trending in Education. I'm Mike Palmer. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm going to be posting a lot of stuff coming out of the conference. We're going to be doing some polls, voting on these trends so you understand where they're going. And thank you very much for a wonderful conversation. How are we feeling, Austin? All right. Thank you.